requirements for people with more than one sphincter because Zhao just ripped me a new asshole. Bri-Bri, we gotta get out of here fast. Verdi told Zhao we interviewed Tiffany Hine. Zhao feels like we ignored her order to stay out of the case.
But we found a body, Brian said. What are we supposed to do, step over it on the way to getting donuts and coffee?
Pookie nodded. I guess. She knows we were told Verdi was on the way, but we kept at it anyway, and that pisses her off. If she finds out we're here to look at Oscar, she'll bronze our balls and put them on her desk next to the picture of her family.
Robin didn't know much about internal police politics, but there had to be much more to the story. Would Zhao really be that opposed to Brian and Pookie being involved in this case? Brian ground his teeth. Frustration was an emotion he didn't bother to hide.
So what now? He said. Do we turn the fortune-teller lead over to Verdi?
Hell no, Pookie said. In fact, I just called Mr. Biznass, and he's expecting us in 20 minutes. Listen, Robin, we gots to go. Mum's the word on this visit, right?
Of course, Robin said. Like I said earlier, I shouldn't have told you anything.
Pookie walked out. Brian looked at Robin for a long moment, then followed his partner. Robin stared after him, already trying to read meaning into his words, and already hating herself for doing it. Chapter 49 Mr. Biznass North Beach, San Francisco's Little Italy, sits right next to Chinatown. As a little boy, Brian had often walked through both neighborhoods with his father. The change from one to the next is so abrupt, so distinct, Brian thought that gates manned by international border guards wouldn't have seemed the least out of place. One minute you're walking through dense throngs of Chinese people, picking through the fruit and vegetable-packed crates outside tiny grocery stores, all signs and conversation in Asian languages. The next minute, you're looking at calm sidewalks with cafe tables full of people drinking espresso, old dudes letting out snippets of conversation in Italian, and every lamppost ringed with stripes of green, white, and red. North Beach primarily supports two types of street-level businesses, an endless supply of food represented by restaurants, bakeries, butchers, and candy shops, and in the kitsch, represented by stores full of souvenir crap, overpriced clothing, and even more overpriced art. Above those numerous food and kitsch shops sits the second layer of North Beach, represented by faded signs in the windows that advertise importers, exporters, olive oil merchants, tailors, and more. Mr. Biznass had one of those second-story stores, just a flight up from Stella Pastry and Cafe. His sign wasn't faded. A blue neon eye set in a red neon hand, with the white neon words, Fortune Teller, curving beneath.
Convenient, Pookie said. Once we're done talking to this guy, we come downstairs for some scarapentina cake.
The choo-choo needs gas.
The metaphor is coal, actually, Pookie said.
He adjusted the four overstuffed manila folders under his arm, just before their contents spilled onto the sidewalk.
Brains require chemicals like potassium and sodium. Sugar is also a chemical, Brian. Ergo, my brain needs sugar. It's what they call science.
The guy who believes in the invisible sky daddy is quoting science?
Yep, Pookie said. And he's about to have a nice chit-chat with a black magic pagan. Confession will be a bitch this week. By the way, I didn't tell Mr. Biznass we were cops.
Brian nodded.
Always good to surprise him a little.
Far as I'm concerned, this guy's a suspect, Pookie said. But I don't want to move too fast. He's the only person of interest we have.
Brian wasn't going to get excited about this, not yet. The fortune-telling Thomas Reed, a.k.a. Mr. Biznass, had only been looking for info on the symbols. That meant he might have some connection to the case, or, more likely, he'd just seen the symbol somewhere and wanted to know more. Still, people didn't make requests to the SFPD into the city out of pure curiosity.
Pooks, what kind of a name is Biznass, anyway?
Maybe he's like Elvis, Pookie said, as in, taking care of business. Ready to get some answers?
Brian was. He'd take just about any answer at this point. He had a small headache, and that was the least of his pains. His rebellious body tried to drag him down, but he refused to give in. At least for now, he could muscle through and ignore the fact that it hurt to move, even hurt to breathe. They entered the ground floor door, then climbed the stairs, the smell of incense from above mixed with the smell of pastries from below. No question which upstairs door belonged to Mr. Biznaz. It was bright red, with a blue eye icon painted on it. They walked in. Inside was a man dressed in red robes with blue trim, and a blue turban decorated with glass rubies. He had to be 60. If his face was any benchmark, every one of those 60 years was hard. He sat in a red throne-like chair. In front of his chair, a blue crystal ball rested on a table draped with a red velvet cloth. Two cheap blue plastic chairs sat on the other side of the table. His outfit was something one might find on a 1960s Hollywood Prince of India, but his face looked anything but royal. Thrice broken nose, pallid, wrinkled skin, and a left eyelid half hanging over his iris in a perpetual stop-action wink. The man waved them in. In his left fist, he held a small, cylindrical object. He pressed the object to his throat.
"Welcome,"
he said in a mechanical voice.
"Please come in."
Brian and Pookie stopped, stared.
"Don't mind my handicaps. I am vocally assisted."
"A voice box," Pookie said. "A fortune teller with a voice box."
"Handicaps?" Brian said. "Plural?"
"I also have a mild case of coprolalia."
Brian and Pookie exchanged a look.
"Tourette syndrome."
"Of course," Pookie said. "A fortune teller with a voice box and Tourette's."
"It's on my Facebook page. Do some research next time. Chitty balls, fuckle sniff. Don't mind my cursing. It's just my handicap. Come and sit."
Brian and Pookie sat on the blue plastic chairs.
"Which one of you is Pookie?"
Pookie raised his hand.
"That's me."
Mr. Biznaz leaned forward and circled his right hand over the blue glass ball. He stared into it, scowling like he saw the fires of hell inside. If Brian hadn't already been so taken aback by the guy's handicaps, he would have laughed at the overly dramatic act.
"Tell me what you want to know. I am in communication with the Bricker-Dicker spirits."
"We're cops," Pookie said. "We need to ask you some questions about a case."
Brian held out his badge. Pookie did the same. The hand stopped in mid-wave. Mr. Biznaz looked up without moving his head, eyes peeking out from beneath gray-speckled brows. The scowl vanished, replaced by a wide-eyed, "oh shit" expression.
"Cops."
"Take it easy," Pookie said. "We just want to ask you some questions."
Biznaz looked at them both, eyes flicking back and forth. He seemed to be waiting for something. When whatever that was didn't come, he spoke again.
Questions about what?"
29 years ago, you submitted a request to the SFPD about information on some symbols."
The man's eyes widened in fear.
"I don't want any trouble. Don't rough me up."
Brian wondered why the guy was so nervous. What kind of an operation was he running up here? Besides the obvious scam of pretending to know the future in order to bilk the gullible out of their money, of course.
"It's no big deal," Pookie said. "We're working on a case. We need some help. We're not here to hassle you."
The eyes flicked back and forth again.
"You just want to know why I made the request. That's it."
Pookie nodded. Biznaz seemed to relax, just a little. His expression grew hopeful.
"I was working on a book."
"Nice," Pookie said. "An author. A fortune-telling author with Tourette's and a voice box. What's the name of your book?"
"I didn't finish it. What do you want?"
Pookie opened one of his manila folders. He took out the photos of the bloody symbols and gently slid them across the table. Mr. Biznaz looked at them. His eyes grew wide. The guy recognized those symbols, and they scared the hell out of him.
Cockety twat, cockety twat, cockety twat.
Take a breath, Biz, Pookie said. Easy, man, just take a breath.
Mr. Biznass dropped his voice box. It rolled across the red velvet surface. He put both hands palms down on the table, then took three long, slow, deep breaths. That seemed to calm him. His face relaxed. He looked at Pookie, then at Brian, like he was waiting for them to do something. When they did nothing, Biznass eased back in his throne. He reached out a shaking hand, picked up the voice box off the table, and held it to his throat.
Never seen those before.
Brian laughed.
Of course not. That's why you almost shit yourself. Or is incontinence another one of your handicaps? A little late to pretend you don't know what those are.
Mr. Biznass glared at him. Was the man scared of the symbols? Or scared that the cops knew about the symbols and had come a-calling? Biznass was a fortune teller, a psychic. Could he have projected the dreams into Brian's head? Brian instantly wanted to punch himself for thinking such ridiculous thoughts. Fortune tellers were scam artists, nothing more. Still, Mr. Biznass knew something about the symbols. He had to have some answers. Brian leaned forward and rested his elbows on the table.
Come on. Where have you seen these symbols?
Biznass looked back and forth between the two cops, seemed to size them up.
I don't know, dicker, pricker, nothing.
Pookie reached into a folder and pulled out a picture of Oscar Woody's mutilated corpse. He slid the picture across the table. Biznass shook his head like he didn't want to believe the picture was real.
People are dying, Pookie said. We need to know what you know. If you don't want to talk here, we can take you downtown.
That concept seemed to scare Biznass even worse than the pictures. He started to breathe rapidly, bordering on hyperventilating.
Take it easy, Pookie said. All you have to do is talk to us, and this stays right here.
The man gently rubbed his crooked nose. He looked up, that doubtful expression back in his eyes.
Did you tell your big bosses you were coming? Does anyone know you're here?
Brian sat very still, as if the tiniest motion might spook the guy. Pookie seemed to be playing it perfectly.
One other guy knows, Pookie said, but that's it. He's not our boss, just a guy who looked up the symbols on our computer system. No report has been filed or anything like that. I take it you want this conversation to stay between us?
No one knows my name. Shitty balls, fuckle sniff.
Pookie crossed himself.
We promise.
The fortune teller reached out his left fist.
Word is bond.
Pookie reached out, bumped fists.
Word is bond.
Mr. Biznass nodded. Finally, he looked down at the photos.
Tell me where you found these.
Murder scenes, Pookie said. Two teenage boys, both in a gang called Boys Company. One died two nights ago, one before dawn this morning. Aside from your information request, we couldn't find these symbols anywhere in police records. Tell us what they are.
Biznass looked up, shook his head. Brian felt his patience slipping away. He stood up.
Listen, asshole. You're about 10 seconds from going from person of interest to my number one suspect.
Pricker, dicker, fucker, sucker.
What did you say to me?
Brian, relax, Pookie said. It's a condition.
Yes, it is a condition. I am sorry. Dicker, pricker, licker.
Bullshit, Brian said. This guy doesn't have a condition.
I'm disabled.
A hand on Brian's arm.
Chill, Pookie said. Let the man talk, okay?
Brian sat back down and crossed his arms over his chest.
These symbols are for Marie's children. It is a cult. You are cops. You have heard of them?
Pookie shook his head.
I've been with the SFPD for 10 years. I've never heard of Marie's children.
Brian hadn't heard of them either. He remained quiet. Pookie was making progress. Biznas stared, as if he was waiting to be the butt of a punchline. He waited for a few seconds, then shrugged.
A witch named Marie and her son, called Firstborn, arrived in San Francisco during the gold rush. They and their followers were supposedly responsible for multiple murders in the city. Some accounts claim they were cannibals. Chitty balls! Fucklesniff! A group called the Saviors rounded up dozens of Marie's children, burned them at the stake in 1873.
Brian's bullshit detector went off big time.
Dozens of people? Burned at the stake? Even that long ago, no way that happened and we've never heard about it.
People don't want to know about the bad parts of history. Not something you put on the tourist pamphlet, but cops should know.
Why? Pookie said. Why should the cops know?
Because Mary's children have been killing ever since. Quietly for the most part, but there have been some high-profile serial murders. And some chitty balls rumors they did assassinations for the mob.
Brian closed his eyes and rubbed his temples. The minor headache had blossomed into something that threatened to put him down.
I'm not buying it, he said. How high profile could they be if I've never heard of them?
Biznas stared at Brian.
You've heard of the Golden Gate Slasher?
Brian and Pookie exchanged a glance. The Slasher was the city's biggest serial killer, a monster that had slaughtered children. He'd murdered more victims than better-known psychopaths like the Zodiac Killer, David Carpenter, and Luis Aguilar. Biznas tapped the photos.
These symbols were found when they caught the Golden Gate Slasher.
No way, Brian said. There's no way that's true and we've never heard about it.
Biznas stood and walked to his overflowing bookshelves. He pulled out a photo album, flipped through it, then put it back. He did the same twice more. Then on the fourth volume, he found what he was looking for. He walked back to the table and handed the open album to Brian.
Ticker, pricker, fucker, sucker. Read this.
It was a newspaper clipping. The dateline was from 30 years ago. Even protected in the binder, the paper looked yellow, faded and old. To the right of the columns of text, a black-and-white photo showed a symbol drawn in the dirt. It was the circle and triangle symbol from Brian's dreams, the same symbol they'd found at the scenes of two savage murders. Golden Gate Slasher killed by police. A horrible mystery drew to a close early this morning when a man police identified as the Golden Gate Park Slasher was slain in the very park he terrorized for 10 months. Police have not identified the man. Sources inside the force speculate that the killer's identity may never be known. Inspector Francis Parkmeyer of the San Francisco Police said that fingerprint checks had already placed the John Doe at the scene of all 8 Golden Gate Park child murders that took place from February 18 to the last victim on November 27. John Doe was found near a bowie knife, a weapon police had long ago claimed was the instrument of death in all the murders. Preliminary reports indicate that distinguishing marks on the blade matched marks found on the victim's remains. I have no doubt that we found the Golden Gate Slasher, Parkmeyer said. The prints match, and so does the weapon. The body was found at 5:15 a.m. this morning by a park maintenance crew. Ramon Johnson, a crew member, initially claimed that the presumed killer was stumbling through a grove of trees with an arrow sticking out of his back. After talking with police, Johnson said he had mistaken a stick for an arrow shaft. Parkmeyer denied the presence of an arrow. It was before dawn and the witness's eyes played tricks on him, Parkmeyer said. The John Doe committed suicide. This nightmare is over. We have our city back. Pookie looked up from the article.
I don't get it. This is a multiple homicide, one of the biggest ever. And that symbol isn't common knowledge in the department. Why?
Brian looked to the corner of the clipping. The San Francisco Chronicle's logo seemed darker than the other letters on the page, as if the paper's name itself was more resilient to the ravages of time. He pointed to it.
Maybe the Chronicle's archives will have more information.
Mr. Biznas smiled.
That's a good idea. Look in the archives.
Brian stared at the faded newsprint photo of the symbol. There it was, in black and white. It had been in a major metro newspaper, for one of the biggest cases ever, and yet that wasn't recorded in the SFPD system. Black Mr. Burns had discovered deleted information, but this was another level entirely. Was someone protecting a serial killer? Protecting this Marie's Children cult? Or even both at the same time?
Parkmeyer lied about the arrow. I talked to Ramon Johnson. He's dead now. Ticker pricker of natural causes. But I tracked him down and interviewed him before he died. He said he saw an arrow in the killer's back. He said the killer drew the symbol in the dirt even as he was dying.
Biznas took the scrapbook and flipped to another page. He handed it over. Brian noticed the dateline. May 5, 1969. The headline read, Hua Qing Massacre. Below the headline, a faded, yellowed, black-and-white photo showed three dead men covered in black-spotted white sheets. The black was blood, and there was a lot of it. On a wall behind the bodies, slightly out of focus, Brian again saw it. The circle and triangle symbol from the Oscar Woody murder. The symbol from the Jay Parlar murder. The symbol from his dreams. What the hell was he supposed to make of this? Biznas took the scrapbook, closed it, and put it back on the shelf. He walked back to his throne and sat.
I've given you information. I'm done.
We need more, Brian said. We need more.
Biznas shook his head.
I can't. I gave you more chitty balls than you fuckersniff had before.
The man had given great info, but now the fear was back in his eyes. What was he afraid of? Brian looked to Pookie.
Biz, baby, this is great, Pookie said. You gave us a lot, and we thank you.
Biznas nodded.
Give us one more thing, Pookie said. This thing I ask for, it's like nothing. You researched this, so I'm betting you know what these symbols mean.
Biznas thought for a moment, then leaned forward and looked closely at the photos on his table. He used his right index finger to trace parts of the symbol as he talked. He started with the slashed curve that was part of both drawings.
This is a symbol for the San Francisco Bay. The two lines represent the entrance to the ocean between the two peninsulas.
He pointed to the symbol that showed a lightning bolt going through a circle, with the two half-circles on either side.
The center circle represents the egg from which the witches were spawned.
One womb flashed through Brian's mind.
The half-circles used to be arms reaching out to protect the egg. Somewhere along the way they were simplified. The jagged line represents human blood. This is the symbol of Marie's Children.
Brian leaned in.
So the symbol at the side of the murderers means Marie's Children killed the boys?
That's exactly what it means.
I don't get it, Pookie said. The boys were in a minor gang. Why would Marie's Children go after them?
Mr. Biznas shrugged.
We think the killers might be wearing masks, Pookie said. Costumes and the like. That ring any bells?
Story goes that Marie's Children dressed up to look like monsters to terrify victims before killing them.
I knew it, Pookie said. Hear that, Brian?
Brian said nothing. Costumes could explain what he'd seen in his dream, what Tiffany Hine had seen, but could it explain what Robin had found? Pookie picked up the photo of the lightning bolt symbol.
Biz, you sure this is the work of Marie's Children? Could someone be faking it?
Most certainly, Or maybe someone thinks, shitty balls, they are Marie's children.
Brian touched the picture of the triangle symbol, the one that scared him so bad it was like touching a blow-up photo of a spider that might come alive and bite you. He pushed it toward Biznaz.
And what about this one?
First recorded instance in 1892. Circle represents an egg, but also represents the eye of a hunter. The unfinished triangle is a symbol of protection against the demons that hunt Marie's children.
Demons? Pookie said.
The saviors. It is a symbol of protection against the saviors.
Brian remembered the fear from his dreams, could feel it even at that moment, a cold fist below his heart.
How about that? The killers have a boogeyman all their own.
I helped you. Now leave.
Brian started to ask for more, but before he could, Pookie shook hands with the fortune teller.
Biz, baby, you're a good man, Pookie said. If we have more questions later?
Biz hesitated, then reached into his jacket and handed Pookie a business card. There was nothing on the card but a number.
That is a prepaid phone, not traceable to me.
A prepaid phone, Brian said. What are you, a drug dealer?
It's my booty call phone. A lot of lonely housewives come to get their fortunes read. If you... You're a pricker, dicker, fucker, sucker! Know what I mean?
Pookie nodded respectfully.
A play has gotta play, Biz. A play has gotta play. Thanks again. We'll be in touch. Brian, let's go.
Pookie quickly walked to the door and held it open. Brian hesitated, staring at the charlatan who had surprised him with real information. He knew that Biz had more to share, but maybe Pookie was right. Maybe this was all they could get for now. Brian walked out the door and headed down the stairs to Columbus Avenue. Brian watched Pookie slide a fork into his second piece of yellow scarapuntina cake. He put the fork in his mouth, then hummed as he chewed.
This is so good, he said. It's like a Twinkie on steroids. Sure you don't want a piece?
Brian still regretted the kielbasa that sat like a sour brick in his stomach. He could smell the sugar, the flour, even the lemon flavoring in Pookie's cake. One bite of that and his swirling stomach would rebel. He shook his head.
I'm tripping, Pooks. Our best lead and what do we have to work with? I mean, a witch's coven? Mob hitmen? 100-year cover-up of some kind? Come on!
Why not? There's a reason Oscar and Jay were killed. Some kind of occult connection is as good a lead as anything else. I'll start digging into the Golden Gate slasher case. And by I'll start digging, I mean I'll get Black Mr. Burns to do it for me.
Do you ever do your own detective work?
Yes, Pookie said. I can detect cockknockers. Wait, I detect one sitting across the table from me now. She gonna want some cake?
No, Brian said. I don't want cake. I want to find out what's going on.
Pookie nodded slowly.
We'll get this figured out, Brian. The dream thing doesn't make any sense, and I know that's messing with you. But I need you to try and relax so your brain works right.
I don't want to relax.
Come on, trust Dr. Chang. Did you feel better after seeing your dad?
Yeah, I actually felt sane again.
No,
Brian said.
I didn't.
LLWTL, look, man, if there's a cover-up and the chief of frickin' police is involved, then you know we need to move carefully. Patience, Daniel-san.
Patience. Easy for Pookie to say. And yet patience was exactly what they needed. Brian was a hunter. If he lost his shit now, he might spook the prey. Someone was responsible for all of this. Brian wouldn't rest until he found out who that was. Chapter 50. Hector's Revenge. Aggie James picked up the Tupperware container that had been tossed his way. It hurt to do even that. His body ached. He needed a hit. Something. Anything. Drying out sucked. He opened the container and smelled it. His trembling stomach rejoiced at the scent of the brown stew filled with carrots, potatoes, and thick chunks of some stringy meat. The old lady had come with her cart again. They hadn't drawn his chain all the way back this time. He could move enough to reach the food. That made him potentially dangerous, he supposed. But the old lady didn't seem to worry about him. She came close, leaned in, then sniffed. This time her scarf was pink with big red spots. She wore a brown skirt instead of gray, but the sweater and shoes were the same.
"The stew looks good," Aggie said. "What's in it?"
She stopped sniffing him long enough to look him in the eye.
"It's good for you. Eat."
She had spoken to him. It was the first English he'd heard in days.
"Lady, what's your name?"
"Hillary."
She reached into her cart and threw a sandwich to the Chinaman wearing the Super Bowl 21 shirt. He caught it and ripped open the brown paper. He said something that sounded like "shay shay," then shoved a big bite into his mouth as he crawled forward on his knees until his chain pulled taut.
"Please,"
he said to Hillary as he chewed.
"I no talk. I leave. Please. Please."
His sandwich looked like egg salad. The man was terrified. He had tears in his eyes, yet he still crammed the food into his mouth, chewed and swallowed as fast as he could. Aggie recognized that behavior all too well. If you didn't know when or where your next meal might come from, or if someone was going to kick your ass and take your food away, you ate as much as you could as fast as you could.
"Please,"
the Chinaman said. Hillary just stared at him. What a group they were. Aggie the bum, Hector the Mexican, and the hungry Chinaman. Hector had two sandwiches lying in front of him. He hadn't touched them. Hillary had come twice since the masked men had taken his wife. Hector didn't move a lot anymore, just lay there in a fetal ball. Aggie couldn't blame the guy. Wife and kid gone.
"And you know exactly what that feels like."
"Please, please,"
the Chinaman said to Hillary. He shoved the last of the sandwich into his mouth, then pushed his fingers and palms together, like he was praying.
"I no talk, please."
Hillary rattled off a sharp, short phrase of what sounded like that chinky-chong talk, and the Chinaman shrank away. He fell to his ass, then back-crawled until he hit the white wall.
"Damn, Hillary," Aggie said. "What did you say to him?"
"I told him I'll bring egg rolls next time,"
Hillary said, without looking away from the man.
"You got egg rolls?"
She looked at Aggie again.
"You don't seem as scared as he does. Why?"
Aggie shrugged.
"Doesn't look like I'm going anywhere unless you let me go. Besides, I got nothing to live for. I'm pretty scared, I guess. If I'm gonna die, I'm gonna die. And maybe you've been trying to kill yourself for years, but you don't have the balls to do it right."
"There are different ways of dying," she said. "Some worse than others. You don't know what's going to happen to you."
Aggie shrugged again.
"What's gonna happen is what's gonna happen. Maybe I'm a little..."
He paused as a shiver ripped him from toes to nose.
"A little preoccupied right now."
"You're already feeling better. I can..."
Her voice trailed off, but somehow Aggie knew that she'd been about to say, "You're feeling better. I can smell it." Had the Mexican woman smelled better too? Aggie decided to stop thinking about that. He didn't want to know if he was right.
"I'd be better still if I could get my medicine," he said. "How about it, lady? Can I get my medicine I had on me when I came in?"
"No."
"But I need my medicine. I'm sick."
Hillary shook her head.
"You don't need it, or you won't soon. We've had many like you here before. You'll be fine in another day or two."
Aggie had dried out before.
Sure, the shakes would be gone, as would the shits and the pukes, but he'd be far from fine. Losing the shakes didn't help you forget. The smack did.
I need it, Aggie said.
Hillary smiled.
Perhaps in a few days this need will be the least of your problems.
The white jail cell door swung open with its grinding metallic squeak. 6 white-robed men came in, hoods pulled up over monster masks. Wolf face, pig face, Hello Kitty, a bug, and a demon face. The last one, though, wore the black-skinned, red-lined face of Darth Maul. Wolf face carried the pole with a hook. Demon face held the remote control. The Chinaman stared and muttered rapid-fire words that Aggie didn't understand. The guy had been unconscious when they brought him in. This was his first time seeing the freak show. The white-robed men closed in on Hector. Hector didn't move. He remained in a fetal position. Demon Face pressed a button on the remote. The chain started to clank. Aggie hustled back to the wall, scooping up his chain as he went. He rested his neck against the hole, letting the chain play through his fingers so it wouldn't loop his foot or anything like that. The Chinaman was freaked, but not so freaked he didn't mimic Aggie's actions. Hector's chain pulled tight, started dragging him, and still he didn't react. The monster-faced men closed in. Even as he slid, 4 sets of hands grabbed at his arms and legs. The wooden pole descended, its metal hook reaching for his collar. Then Hector's chain rang with a strange new clank. It stopped retracting. Aggie looked to the hole that led to the wall. There, his chain was balled into some kind of knot large enough that it wouldn't fit through the stainless steel flange. The monster-faced men looked too, their black-gloved hands stopping in mid-motion around the Mexican's hands and feet. In the brief, still silence that filled the white room, Hector spoke.
Ore su turno, cabrones!
His hand shot out under a white robe, grabbed a foot and yanked. Pigface went down hard. Feet pulled out from under him like some cartoon character walking into one of those rope traps, his head thonking audibly off the floor's white stones.
He tricked him. He was just playing possum.
Hector moved like a pissed-off street cat fighting a pack of small, slow dogs. He shook off their grip, and with the same motion was on his feet. He kicked out, planting his foot hard in the stomach of Bugface. Bugface let out a grunt, then dropped. 2 men down in less than a second.
Hit him!
Aggie screamed.
Hit him!
Hello Kitty grabbed Hector's left arm as Darth Maul pulled a lead pipe out of his sleeve and swung it in a low, horizontal arc, aiming for Hector's knee. The Mexican twisted at the last second, like those guys in that Ultimate Fighting stuff, bending his knee away from the pipe and taking the hit in the crook of his leg. His face wrinkled up. That hit hurt, but not as bad as if it had taken him in the kneecap. God damn, but that beaner was fast. Hector reached out with his free right hand and ripped the wood pole out of Wolfface's hands. Darth Maul brought the pipe back for another knee shot, but the Mexican jabbed the stick butt into Maul's latex mask. Darth Maul let out a scream the likes of which Aggie had never heard, high-pitched and clicky. Black-gloved hands shot inside the hood as Maul fell to the ground, little feet kicking. The Mexican put the end of the stick on the white floor, then drove his long foot through the shaft, snapping it in half and leaving him holding a long, jagged shard of white wood. Hector snarled. He jammed that shard right under the Hello Kitty mask. Blood sprayed. From the floor, Pigface grabbed Hector's feet. Wolfface dove in and wrapped his white-robed arms around Hector's chest. Demonface snagged the lead pipe off the floor. It went up fast, then came down faster in a vicious arc ending on the Mexican's head. Hector sagged. He disappeared beneath a flurry of white robes, punching black fists, kicking feet, and a swinging pipe that did not stop. Aggie couldn't look away, couldn't stop seeing, couldn't stop hearing. Over and over again, the repeated whiff, gong, crack of the pipe coming down on Hector's shins, his knees, his feet, his hands. Each time the metal met flesh and bone, it was answered with a cry of agony.
Hector stopped moving, but the beating continued. Infinite moments later, Wolfface and Pigface grabbed the Mexican's shattered hands and dragged him out of the room. Blood-soaked pajamas left long red smears against the white floor. Two more white-robed men appeared, the Joker and Jason Voorhees. They helped Pigface and Bugface drag away the still twitching Hello Kitty and the unmoving Darth Maul. Hello Kitty's blood ran a zigzag curving path between the cobblestone's low points until it drained into the same hole Aggie and the others used to shit and piss. Hillary calmly rolled her Safeway shopping cart out the door. The wheels still squeaked, but only a little. She stopped and looked back at Aggie.
"A nouvier will come up this up soon," she said.
She shut the cage door behind her. Silence filled the bright room, broken only by the soft whimpers of the Chinaman. Hector had fought like a motherfucker with nothing to lose. Aggie James also had nothing to lose, but he couldn't fight for shit. When the masked men came for him, he knew he wouldn't be able to stop them. Chapter 51 Blue Balls. People were going to start talking. For the second night in a row, Pookie had to help Brian to his apartment. The guy was beyond sick. How he'd managed to put on a good soldier face during the meetings with Biznas and Zhao was beyond Pookie's ability to relate. 3 days of this sickness, yet Pookie still felt fine. Those flu shots came in handy.
"I feel like crap," Brian said. "I don't want to go to sleep. I don't want to dream anymore."
Dreaming might be a necessary evil, because sleep was exactly what Brian needed. The guy couldn't keep going without rest. That kind of thing wore a body down.
"So does jumping 8 feet into the air, huh, Pooks?"
No, Pookie wasn't going to rehash that crap again. What he'd thought he saw couldn't be, and that was that. Just heat-of-the-moment memories playing tricks on him. Pookie leaned Brian against the hallway wall while he opened Brian's door.
"Klauser, you're a real rocket scientist, you know that?"
"Why?"
Pookie helped him inside.
"Because you've got a fat Chinese dude with a Chicago accent taking care of you, when you could have a hot little brunette medical examiner giving you a sponge bath instead."
"Really, Pooks? You want to ride my ass about Robin now?"
"You and Robin are made for each other," Pookie said. "It's like math."
"You hate math."
"My hate doesn't make it any less accurate. And remember my grandfather's advice. You can fuck your math teacher, but you can't fuck math."
Brian fell onto his bed, lay there for a second, then started sitting up.
"I don't think your grandpa said that."
"Well, someone did. Maybe it was me."
"I'm so surprised."
Brian slid off the bed. His knees wobbled and he almost fell.
"Brian, go to sleep."
He shook his head.
"I told you I'm not sleeping. I can't, Pooks."
If Brian didn't get some serious rest, the dreams and Marie's children and the murders wouldn't really matter to him anymore. He'd die from exhaustion. Pookie had to talk him down.
"Tell you what," Pookie said. "Your bad dreams usually come in the wee hours of the morning. I'll wake up at midnight."
Brian stared out from sunken, bloodshot eyes. His dark red beard had been borderline unkempt 3 days ago. Now he was starting to look like Charlie Manson. Not a good image, considering.
"Midnight. You promise?"
"Yeah," Pookie said. "And I'm staying right here. Just don't walk in your sleep and try to get some, because we both know you've been after me for years."
Pookie eased Brian back onto the bed. A sweaty head hit a cool pillow. Pookie had cast his lot with his partner. He would ride this out to the end.
"I got your back, brother," Pookie said. "I won't fail you."
Brian didn't answer.
"Brian?"
A snore. He was already asleep. Pookie turned off the light, stepped into the box-strewn hall, and closed the bedroom door. Another night on his friend's couch. Pookie hadn't slept on couches this much since he'd been married. He turned on Brian's TV and watched a little local news. Jay Parlar's death led. The anchor looked so upset. And the street reporter outside of Jay's place, yeah, she looked real somber as well. Reporters were fucking vampires that lived off the blood of others. Pookie turned off the TV. He took off his jacket. Might as well get comfortable. He pulled his notepad from his jacket pocket. Things were crazy. His partner was a total mess, and there might very well be a murderous conspiracy afoot in the San Francisco Police Department, but that didn't mean Pookie could just ignore his other vital duties. Blue balls, take me away. In Hollywood, everything works out just fine for the cops. He started scribbling notes for his series Bible, hoping the work would let him tune everything out, at least for a little while. Chapter 52. Roberta. Rex drew. Alex Panos this time. No axes, no chainsaws, and no monsters. Just Alex. Alex and Rex. It felt good to draw it. Rex felt his dick stiffen as he sketched a look of pain in Alex's eyes. The pencil flew, a scritch-scratching sound so fast it was a constant hiss. Shapes formed, circles, ovals, and cylinders that became faces, chests, arms and legs. Curves became blood. Yeah. Yeah, it was good. It was good. Rex's breaths came faster, shallower. His face felt hot. His heartbeat hammered inside his head. Maybe he wasn't supposed to get turned on by this, but he didn't care anymore. The blood and pain and death spun him up, and now he knew why the boys at school talked about porn all the time. More lines. Rex grabbed a colored pencil. Alex's severed hand took shape, flash frozen in a spray of red. Rex drew with his right hand. His left hand reached down, unzipped his pants, and slid inside. This would be his best drawing yet. His best drawing ever. Moments went by, and time vanished. Rex saw only lines to be drawn and shapes to be made. His bedroom door opened, breaking the trance. Rex's head snapped up. There stood Roberta. She was already holding the belt. Her gaze slid down, her forehead furrowed. Rex looked down as well. His little hard dick was in his hand. Oh, no.
The school called me, Roberta said.
She stepped into his room, slammed the door shut behind her. Rex was trapped.
They said you skipped school again. So I came to teach you better, and what do I find? I find you being a nasty boy. Dirty, nasty, touching yourself. But, Mom, I... Don't you call me Mom! You're no son of mine, you nasty, nasty thing!
Rex looked down and started to zip up when he heard a crack sound and felt the sting across his left cheek. He sucked in a half-breath of surprise. His hand touched his face. The skin hurt.
That's right, Roberta said, the belt dangling from her right hand. I'll teach you to be a dirty, sinning boy in my house!
The belt snapped out again. Rex ducked away, but tripped on his desk stool. He and the stool fell. The back of his head thonked against the floor.
Don't you duck, you sinner! You take what's coming to you!
He tried to get up. His arms and legs seemed to move in slow motion. Crack across his forehead, then on his nose. He brought his arms up in front of his face.
Dirty!
Crack on his shoulder. A deep stinging.
Nasty!
Rex grabbed the overturned stool, tried to use it to help him scramble to his feet. Crack across his back, the flash of pain so bad he cried out.
I'll teach you, you worthless little...
Rex stood and swung, did both things so fast he didn't even know what he was doing. There was a sound like a bat hitting a softball. Then he heard something crash on the floor. Rex blinked away tears. He opened his eyes. He was holding his stool by the base of one leg, the edge of the rounded seat. It had blood on it. And on the floor, Roberta, moving slow like she was drunk, bleeding bad from her right cheek, her eyes glazed and unfocused. The belt was still in her hand.
nasty, she said, getting my paddle.
This pathetic thing was the woman who had beaten him so many times. Why had he let her do that? For the same reason he had allowed Boyko to ruin his life. Because he'd been a coward. Because he'd been afraid. But Rex wasn't weak anymore.
You're a bully, he said quietly. I hate you.
She puckered her lips and then puffed out, like someone trying to blow away a long strand of stray hair. Flecks of blood sprayed from her lips. She tried to sit up. She didn't get far before Rex put a foot on her chest and pushed her to her back. He reached down and tore the belt from her hands. Roberta blinked. The glazed look vanished. She looked up at him with enraged eyes, grabbed his leg and tried to push it away. His leg didn't move. How had he once thought of her as strong? Her hands and arms, so weak they couldn't even budge him.
Let me go!
She dug her fingernails into his calf. This time, Rex saw the pain coming. He let it happen and found it wasn't that bad. He pressed his foot down harder. Her eyes widened. She dug deeper with her nails, so he pressed harder still. Now her eyes scrunched tight. Her mouth opened in an airless scream. Her hands slapped at his foot and leg. Rex smiled. How exciting! All the things he'd felt when he made the drawings, they were nothing compared to the thunderstorm in his chest, the hurricane in his head. He dangled the belt so that the end slid across her face.
You like this belt, Roberta? You like it so much? Let's see how much you really like it.
He took his foot off her chest, then swung the belt as hard as he could. The leather cracked across her face, leaving an instant red mark. Roberta screamed. She flipped onto her belly and scrambled for the door, crawling even as she started to rise.
She's running.
His excitement spiked up to an impossible level. Rex ran after her. She stumbled into the hall and almost reached the front door before he kicked her feet out from under her. She fell hard, her face hitting the hardwood. He moved in front of her and blocked the door.
Where are you going, Roberta? Aren't you going to teach me a lesson?
She lurched to her right, crawled into the TV room. He followed her. He caught her next to her TV chair. She started to beg, but only got out a few words before Rex wrapped the belt around her neck. Her eyes bulged. Her hands shot to the cracked black leather.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on!
Rex pulled the belt tighter. Chapter 53 The Golden Gate Slasher. The department's electronic records of the Golden Gate Slasher case had been spotty at best. That didn't surprise John Smith. The case was old enough that all initial reports had been done on typewriters or word processors before the SFPD implemented a database. Reports that old had to be scanned or hand-coded into the system. With hundreds of thousands of pre-database cases, even high-profile records didn't always get transferred. Vast amounts of the SFPD's records still existed only on paper, slowly fading, degenerating, slipping away into the untouchable realms of lost history. The Internet didn't give up much either. The Golden Gate Slasher wasn't even on Wikipedia. In a culture fascinated by murderers, a culture that celebrated crime, this serial killer had gone surprisingly unheralded. So John had come down to the archives to see the real McCoy. A white cardboard box in a climate-controlled room was all that remained of one of San Francisco's ugliest summers. Crime scene reports, medical examiner notes, evidence tags, a ton of information, although it seemed very scattered and disorganized. Maybe John was too damn scared of his own shadow to provide any real help, but he could make himself useful digging through these files. He hated who he had become. Once upon a time, in a fairy tale land, he'd been a real cop. He'd been a man. Now he was a glorified secretary. Every night he woke up in a cold sweat. Not with nightmares, exactly, but rather with playback memories so real they made that moment come to life all over again. Pookie had been obsessed with exposing a dirty cop named Blake Johansson, who was taking payoffs from gangs to ignore certain cases. Chief Zhao had told them to leave Johansson alone, but Pookie wouldn't let up. He kept digging for dirt, kept banging away for that bit of evidence that would put the guy away. John had also wanted to let it go, let internal affairs handle it, but Pookie refused to stop. And, like a good partner, John had been there every step of the way. A tip led them to the Tenderloin, where they hit gold. Johansson taking a payoff from Johnny Yi, boss of the Sui Sing Satong. Pookie had rushed things. Instead of calling for backup, he went in. There had been a moment when Pookie had Johansson dead to rights, but that moment passed. Johansson drew. Pookie should have put him down, but he didn't. John would never understand why Pookie hadn't pulled the trigger at that moment. If he had, things would have turned out different. It got crazy from there. Johansson fired, Pookie fired, John fired. Then Johansson ran out the back door. When John followed, he took a bullet in the belly. He never saw the shooter, didn't know where the shooter was, didn't even know if it was Johansson. John crawled 15 feet to a big plastic garbage can for cover. During the crawl, he took a second round, this time in the left calf. Pookie called out. He'd been hit in the thigh. He was pinned down, unable to come to John's aid. For 15 minutes, John Smith cowered behind that garbage can, shoving his fist into the agonizing wound in his belly to try and stop the bleeding. That whole time, bullets kept on coming. John tried to find the shooter, looked at the buildings surrounding him, at the windows, at corners, at trees, but couldn't see anything. He learned that plastic isn't exactly the best bullet-stopping material in the world. Brian Clouser had been the first to respond to shots fired and officer down. Brian, somehow, found the shooter, and found him fast. That exchange lasted all of a few seconds, and ended with 3 new holes in Blake Johansson, 2 to the chest, 1 to the forehead. Since that night, John's life had never been the same. He couldn't go outside without staring at every window, every door, without thinking that every stranger had a gun and was watching him, waiting for him to look away. The shrinks couldn't do shit. John knew he was being crazy, but knowing it and fixing it are 2 different things. The constant numbing fear made it impossible to be a cop. Months later, Chief Zhao had reassigned him to the gang task force as a graffiti expert. Same pay, same rank, but now his days were filled with computers and spent safely behind the walls of the Hall of Justice. Chief Zhao had taken care of John when many people would have cut him loose. He sorted through the box containing case files for the Golden Gate Slasher. What he saw briefly made him glad he didn't have to visit crime scenes anymore. 8 children, ages 6 to 9, murdered over a 10-month period. Yet the case hadn't drawn the same kind of attention as other high-profile serial killers. In fact, it had received almost no national attention. John didn't want to think of the probable reasons for the lack of media coverage, but it was obvious. All the murdered children had been minorities. 6 black kids, an Asian, and a Latino. Back then, the media didn't really give a shit about niggers and spicks and slants. Not that things had changed all that much in the last 30 years. He could turn on cable news any day of the week and see the bias in full effect. A missing pretty white girl? National news for months on end, driven by angry women wearing too much makeup who screamed about it on cable. A missing black girl? Local paper, page 5, running under an ad for Doritos, if she was mentioned at all. John flipped through a forensic summary report.
Holy shit, he said quietly. How can people be like this?
The report showed a detail that the cops had managed to successfully keep out of the papers. The children's bodies had been half-eaten. He thought of the Ladyfinger killer. Both the slasher and Ladyfinger were dead, cases separated by a decade and 2,000 miles, yet both had that symbol,